Hi, folks. It's Denise Howell. We've got an excellent panel coming up on TWiL with Mary Hodder, Larry Downs, and Evan Brown. We're going to talk new decisions on GPS tracking and decryption. We're going to talk both internet and spectrum legislation, copyright law, and more next on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell, episode 146, recorded January 27, 2012. Mary Hodder and the Lifeboat of Fire. This episode of This Week in Law is brought to you by Netflix. Watch thousands of TV episodes and movies on your PC, Mac, iPad, iPhone, or TV instantly. All streamed directly to you, saving you time, money, and hassle. For your free 30-day trial, go to netflix.com/twit. Hey, folks, Denise Howell here, and you've tuned in for This Week in Law. We thought that last week was a big week, but this week it just continues on with story after story. We have much to discuss and a great panel to help us understand everything that's going on. We've got Larry Downs joining us once again. Hello, Larry.
Hi, Denise. Great to be back.
Wonderful to have you. For those of you not familiar with Larry, he is sort of a man about the internet. He writes at Forbes and CNET and various and sundry other places, and always is wonderfully detailed and has great insights about all the very important things going on in law and policy. So we're thrilled to have you here today, Larry.
Thank you.
Also, I just learned off air that one of Larry's students or former students is joining us as well. My good old friend, Mary Hodder. Great to have you back, Mary.
Thank you.
Wonderful to see you again. Mary has been blogging forever at Napsterization and continues to do so. And we've got some great stories along that theme on deck for today. Also joining us from... Yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say, I just had my 10th blog anniversary last October, but I didn't do anything.
I know, you and me both. Yeah, I didn't blog mine either. So happy anniversary to our respective blogs. Also joining us from Chicago, Illinois, and the law firm of Hinshaw & Culbertson is Evan Brown. Hello, Evan.
Hey, how's it going? And you've got it right. You know, like we were talking right before the show, so much has gone on this week. We thought last week was big. And, you know, I was saying we just barely could have enough time to get over the SOPA hangover. And there's plenty more to talk about that. But just, you know, there's no shortage of things to talk about. So it's going to be fun. And by the way, yeah, congratulations. After the fact, 10 years of blogging. That's that is really something. So good work to both of you.
Thank you.
Let's not quite get over our SOPA hangover. Let's continue on that theme for a bit at the beginning of the show here, because Larry's written a great piece entitled "Who Really Stops SOPA and PIPA and Why?" So Larry, answer your own headline question for us, if you would, in a nutshell.
Well, of course, there was a combination of things. As I said in the story, there was a lot of very traditional advocacy work. Some of it I was personally involved in, although I'm not going to take any credit. But the point I think I was trying to make in the story, and the reason I wrote it, is that what I observed both here in Silicon Valley and in Washington over the last couple of months was the emergence of something very different and very new. And that was sort of direct advocacy by internet users using the tools like Reddit, like Twitter, Facebook, Tumblr, and so on, the same tools that they use, you know, to be social networking and doing social news sites. They turned those tools into forces, and it really upset Washington. I was there during the sort of meltdown for SOPA and PIPA, and you know, you could see that, you know, the legislators just didn't know what was hitting them. They didn't know where it was coming from. It was behind. Frankly, they don't know what to do about it.
Yeah, it must have been really interesting to be at the State of the Net conference on the particular days you were there last week. Was there much discussion of all of this?
Yeah, the opening panel at State of the Net this year was about SOPA, and there was another panel that I did the next day on sort of cloud issues, law, and that to another discussion about SOPA. And frankly, every conversation that wasn't about SOPA more or less was, because even as the conference was going, you know, individual congressmen and senators were dropping out left and right. They were sponsors were leaving the bill. Everybody was, you know, starting to condemn it. Of course, Wednesday was the day when everything went black. And I was on Capitol that day making the rounds, visiting various staff offices. And it was just remarkable, the chaos. You just don't see in Washington very often.
I really loved the points that you made in your piece. A couple of them stood out for me. One was the credit that you gave Mike Masnick of TechDirt for sort of getting the ball rolling and keeping SOPA and PIPA in the public eye for as long as it took to really gain the attention and then, you know, jump out beyond the little bubble of people who pay attention to these issues. And Mike, sort of as the representative of this Netroots or Bitroots movement that you describe, I'm sure is pleased to have played the role that he did and to have witnessed the outcome that we saw last week. Do you think that it's more than just Mike Masnick, or Mike is sort of emblematic of lots of people writing about this?
Well, sure. It's certainly more than Mike. I mean, Mike is a very humble guy, and he immediately the credit I tried to give him. And even I wouldn't go as far as to say he deserved all the credit, of course. He was certainly one of the leading people in terms of both volume and passion out there about the dangers of these bills. But, you know, what really happened was readers, particularly on Reddit and Tumblr and Facebook and Twitter, they eventually got the message, and then the snowball started down the hill. And that was what was the really interesting phenomenon, is it really had its own momentum. And certainly by the time we all showed up in Las Vegas 2 weeks ago for CES, it was clear that the momentum had shifted dramatically, and they knew where that snowball was going to land, but they certainly didn't want part of it.
Right. At one point you write that we'd sort of crested a point where the rebels knew what the Death Star's design flaw were and were massing at the gates. The design flaw, if I'm reading your article correctly, was this failure to really comprehend what was in the legislation that they were bandying about. You wrote that many of the folks, you know, toward the end were finally copping to the fact that they'd never used, let alone studied, the infrastructure with which they were casually tinkering. Am I right that that was the flaw?
Well, that was the flaw. I mean, obviously, these were bad pieces of legislation. When PIPA came out, there was a lot of complaint. One of the things that really surprised us was over the summer, we talked to a lot of House members of the House leadership, and they said, look, we hear you about SOPA, about PIPA. We're going to introduce our own version. That version turned out to be SOPA, but they promised that they would make it better. And in fact, it was the exact opposite. They threw in even more junk into SOPA. Really, it was just kind of a tossing spaghetti against the wall. And I think what upset people the most wasn't so much the language of the bills as it was the process by which they were being written, being introduced, being sort of, you know, railroaded through Congress without much debate. In the case of PIPA, no debate. Without really engaging with technology companies, let alone with internet users, and certainly not with engineers who would understand the implications of some of the provisions of the bills. And I think in the end, it became more about the process than the actual text.
Right. And the whole last part of your piece is sort of how sad and depressing it is that having gone through this experience, it doesn't seem like the folks who advanced these pieces of legislation really learned from it. And you have some good advice for them there about taking up residence in the digital realm and actually, you know, realizing that it was not Google and the other big companies who got involved here, but the actual users of the internet, which when you come right down to it is just about everyone.
Yeah, it's really sad. I don't really expect that advice to be taken. Members of Congress were saying that the Wikipedia blackout was a stunt. And certainly the entertainment industry at Sundance this week, I wasn't there. This is one place I didn't get to go. But they were saying this was all about Google, and it was all Google pushing their users to do these things. And then you have poor former Senator Dodd, who's now the president of the Motion Picture Association, saying, what we really need is a summit to work these things out. And the best place to do it would be at the White House. So, let's get the big content companies and the big technology companies together, and we'll actually work out the legislation. Now, that might have been an option 6 months ago. Now it's hopelessly out of the picture. And it just completely fails to recognize the third force in this fight, which emerged over the last couple of months, and that's the user communities themselves.
Mary, do you have any thoughts in the aftermath of SOPA and PIPA going down last week?
Well, I actually just would add to what Larry said, which is I think, the users stood up this week in a way that we haven't really seen them do en masse, right? We always have the tragedy of the commons whenever anything shows up. This started with the DMCA, 14 years ago, and, where everything just sort of slides through Congress around using the internet, and the users are completely in the dark. So I think Larry's right. I mean, now people are aware, and it's different. And one of the things that I've always felt was a problem whenever we talk about any kind of policy, whether it's actually technically implementing policy, this is kind of the code is law side of things versus the real policy side of things, some sort of government initiative. The users are always left out of the quote unquote summit that needs to happen at the White House according to whoever. You never have any user representatives, much less actual users there. And the people who are talking about how to regulate or control or code things rarely have the user perspective because they're not really users. And so I think he's completely dead on with this analysis that it's different now and they actually have to include users.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting that we've had a couple of election cycles go by now where the internet was a big factor in people's lives and ultimately in the presidential elections. And yet the politicians still don't seem to get it, don't seem to get how to engage. Even President Obama, who used it so effectively during his campaign, during his presidency, has just sort of fizzled on that. And I think other folks in Washington are in the same boat. Evan, wouldn't it be nice if, picking up on Larry's themes in his article, that the lawmakers would actually, consult with engineers and or users before they come up with these pieces of legislation they try and ram through?
Yeah, I think that's a very effective observation that you make, Larry, that there's a lot to be learned from how to handle this as a political issue by looking at the engineering that goes into how the internet actually works. And so whether or not politicians could meaningfully do that, consulting with smart people when it comes to how the internet actually works is really kind of the tricky question here, because what I see happening as a phenomenon here, and this is happening in the political sphere, is that debates like the ones over SOPA and PIPA and, to the extent people are talking about ACTA and to the extent people have talked about anything that serves to govern the way that information travels across around through the internet. Network neutrality brings this out a lot. It brings out like a libertarian sense of people, and that doesn't translate very well to the mechanisms for political discussion that happen the way that they are. So that's what really is interesting here. And so far, it's kind of this amorphous sentiment of the users, which aren't well represented in discussions. It wouldn't make any sense to try to do this at the White House because you've just got corporate interests there to the extent that, Google and Facebook and other companies like that could be the proxies of the users for some kind of debate, that would be a good thing. But that's largely ineffective because the interests of those users are often in tension with the corporate interests that are represented there. So the ability for them to serve as proxies would not be that great. So it's something new, something kind of brooding that John Perry Barlow, as you mentioned, Larry, in your article, you know, talked about this kind of lack of the ability or lack of receptivity to being governed that he talked about in the Declaration of Independence of Cyberspace way back in 1996. I guess the one thing I would take most out of this, of Larry's piece, is just learning what a Howard Beale moment is all about. I was only 2 years old when the movie Network came out, so that's something that I've got to go back and pick up now. But, you know, the Howard Beale moment, it underscores for me the importance of all this debate, because I had to consult with Wikipedia, and of course SOPA was going to immediately take Wikipedia offline, so I'm glad I was able to find this out now rather than having to research it in an old-fashioned way in the post-apocalyptic era that you know, that Congress is going to thrust upon us.
So, Denise, I have something to add to this as well.
Yes.
So in the last year and a half, I've been working on personal data ecosystem issues. And for 14 months, I was the chair of the Personal Data Ecosystem Consortium, which is kind of looking at the business side or representing the companies that are trying to build for this emerging market, which is a personal data ecosystem where users would collect their own data and drive interactions. So what does this have to do with SOPA and PIPA? Not that much in a way. But I think my experience with it has been representative of what we're just talking about, which is that, you know, so for the last 3 years, because users are really pissed, the FTC has been holding roundtables with lawyers and a couple of technologists to figure out how to manage the user anger, right? Users are saying, just stop the collection of my data. I'm tired of being followed around. I'm tired of getting an ad for something I looked at last week on Amazon. Like, quit it, right? And so the lawyers at the FTC said, okay, well then let's hold some roundtables. Let's figure it out. And they held roundtables with mostly lawyers and a couple of student technologists, good students. I mean, PhD students who are doing a lot of research and doing great work, but nonetheless, not necessarily practicing technologists who are working in companies with large data sets and actually understanding what's happening in the interaction. You don't really get that at school. I learned that at the information school at Berkeley. Like, you just don't get access to the large data sets till you get out in the real world. So what I found, so I got invited to one a year ago by the FTC. It was held at UC Berkeley, and it was part of the, you know, the Samuelson Clinic and Bolt Law School's work with the FTC around Do Not Track. So Do Not Track is an interesting issue, right? In theory, that should solve the user problem. And much like what we want to see around SOPA and PIPA, where users could, you know, needs could be satisfied by bringing in the user perspective, you know, shouldn't this Do Not Track thing work, right? Well, what's happened is that Do Not Track is being offered up as a solution, and the FTC is behind it because the users are mad. But it's actually not really technically very feasible. It doesn't really bring in, you know, it doesn't really fix the user problem, which is that they don't want other people collecting data about them. And it doesn't, and we miss the opportunity for the market value of the data if we held that data ourselves. But because all the thinking by the folks in the room, the power brokers, has been like, oh, we need the lawyers and we need a couple of technologists, and that really covers it, we've missed out. Now, in response to that, there was a day at Google a few days after that where a bunch of folks got together and said, well, how do we design for privacy, right? So Deirdre Mulligan was there, and folks from CDT, and, you know, a lot of technologists. And what became really apparent really quickly was that the developers, which I sort of am more in that developer group as a product maker, have no idea how to design for privacy. So I guess what I'm pointing out here is that I think it really starts on the ground, where you invite the technologists and the lawyers to sit in a room and hash it out well before you get to the point where you're then having legislation written, because we don't even understand each other. We're not using common language. we don't, the lawyers don't really understand how we build, and we, the technologists, don't really understand why law has to be constructed a certain way, or, you know, as we were talking about before, you know, the issue around how everybody in Silicon Valley would love to take a libertarian view on things. Just don't regulate anything and it'll all be fine, except it's not fine, right? We've got issues. And some of them mm-hmm. have to be taken care of with legislation. I think the real issue is, how do you get the workshops going where the folks sit in a room and start to understand each other and really understand at a deep level, how do we build and how do we write law and how do we deal with law when you're the lawyer who's writing the TOU, the terms of use that contains the privacy and data use. How do you do that? Because right now, for example, in cloud computing, if I go to AWS and I put my new fabulous mobile service up there, I have to pass along the 88 pages of terms of use that Amazon enforces for me down to my users. So even if I want to do the right thing with user data, I can't, because the Amazon terms tell me that I have to pass on all my user data to them. They get to have access to all of it. So I can't even do the right thing if I want to, if I want to use that particular cloud service, which many do.
Yeah, so amen.
This is the bigger issue to me, is we're not talking the same language. We're not talking to each other. We're not figuring it out before we get to legislation.
Yeah. Amen to your suggestion that they figure out a way to do that. I'm sure that lawmakers want to do it, but it seems like, you know, their efforts are not being productive. Perhaps they're just not listening and getting the right people into those meetings, and that if they took a heavy dosage of Larry's advice, Virgil in IRC is asking, do we need to send these government critters to school to learn about the internet? I think so, because I think they've learned how to use it. You know, they'll sit in the halls of Congress and tweet what's going on, or snipe about, you know, how they're annoyed by their opponents. However, but, you know, so they know how to use it. They know how to express, but I'm not sure that the listening and the information gathering piece is really in place. And not to slam the Obama administration too badly, because I really do like what they're doing with their online petition site and, you know, the role that that played in the whole SOPA PIPA unfoldings as well. If the internet sort of won that small round last week, one that we seem to have lost sort of all but done is on ACTA. And once again, Mike Masnick has been, you know, a huge force in keeping this issue in the public eye and has written about it repeatedly. Michael Geist in Canada as well has been pivotal in people even knowing about ACTA, because it was a secret for so long. And I think that Michael got a hold of information early on about what was in the proposed trade agreement. Over at TechDirt, Mike has a great piece to remind us what's going on with ACTA, because it's still out there. What is ACTA and why is it a problem? And to remind us, too, that it's all but done. You know, he says many of the countries involved, including the U.S., have already signed on, and ACTA will go into effect soon, even if the other countries don't sign on. So it seems that we're sort of stuck with this thing. The internet tried to get up in arms about it, and there certainly has been a lot of discussion, but nothing like the reaction we saw last week. Larry, do you have any thoughts on ACTA before we charge ahead to other subjects?
Sure. I mean, in the piece of the puzzle here on ACTA, which may undo it, at least in the United States, is there's a very plausible argument to be made that it's not, in fact, a trade agreement, it's a treaty. And if that turns out to be the case, the fact that the Obama administration has signed it isn't actually the end of it in terms of U.S. ratification. If it's a treaty, and the legal definitions and the Supreme Court case law on this is extraordinarily complicated, so I won't go in. But if the Senate can convince the White House, or if they bring the court ways in, and it turns out that it has to get ratified in the Senate to actually take effect, that could stop it in the United States. You know, ratifying a treaty is very hard on any subject in the Senate. It doesn't take too many members to stop a treaty. So certainly, if anyone is interested in the U.S. in trying to block ACTA, definitely, you know, encourage members of, you know, your senators to put pressure on the White House to submit it for ratification and treat it as if it is a treaty, which it very well may be.
Right. And Euro Nerd in IRC is pointing out to me that the EU has not signed it yet. They're not yet on board. But as Mike points out in his piece, at this late game, it seems like sort of all but done. Evan, any thoughts on this? We've talked about ACTA a lot on the show.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that it's a foregone conclusion that it, you know, well, I mean, the U.S. signed it in October. So, the you know, the nature of the debate is different. And I think, Larry, you're saying this, that the real challenge to it now is kind of more of a procedural one, less than a substantive one. You know, and it's just one of those things where I think the interesting thing to be taken from it is kind of the cultural layer on top of all this stuff. It would have been interesting to see if there could have been as much interest in ACTA taken a year ago. I mean, we've been talking about it for however long it's been around here on the show, but, you know, I mean, we're just, you know, kind of voices crying out in the wilderness here, like what Mike Masnick has been with all this stuff. And so I think it's an interesting phenomenon to see the discussion arising from it now in this post-SOPA, post-PIPA little, you know, phase that we're going through right now, just kind of waiting for the next thing to come out of Congress, kind of like, oh, wait, this is, those things aren't the only thing we should be concerned about. So, you know, it's there's different approaches, different concerns and different mechanisms for doing something about ACTA. That's probably the most important thing to be aware of, I guess.
Mary, any thoughts on ACTA? It seems like, you know, if it does come down, it's going to be just another opportunity for folks to demonstrate the themes in your blog that, you know, the more you tighten your fists, the more star systems will slip through your fingers.
Yeah. Napsterization. People always bat around, you know?
Yeah.
And that was my sense. I actually don't know that much about ACTA to really give you any good analysis, but that was my sense. I looked at it and I thought, we're just all going to rat around this. This is ridiculous. Mm-hmm. You know?
One thing we've got to do, I mean, IRC's really been lighting up with links to the Polish parliament, people wearing, you know, the Guy Fawkes masks over in Poland. Have you seen the, you know, the story about that? I guess that was Poland has been considering ACTA this past week. And so there's a great picture that somebody posted in IRC of, you know, members of the Polish parliament holding up, you know, the little anonymous masks in front of their face. So that's kind of an interesting little vignette in all of this, how it's playing out.
Well, one of the things we might see coming soon from Congress is legislation relating to spectrum auctions and what's going to happen with freeing up mobile spectrum. Larry has written a lot about this and understands it far better than I ever will. So I'm going to let him explain that to us momentarily. In the meantime, I want to thank our sponsor for this episode of This Week in Law, which is Netflix. Netflix streams thousands of TV episodes and movies directly to you instantly, which means you save time, money, and hassle. There are several easy ways to instantly access streaming movies and TV shows on Netflix. You can watch on your PC or Mac or your iPad. The iPad is a great way to go with it. You can watch on your Kindle Fire, which I have been finding a nice way to consume my Netflix instant offerings. You can watch on your iPhone, other Android devices and phones too. If you have a gaming console, an Xbox 360 or a PS3 or a Nintendo Wii, those will all bring it to you. And if you're not a gamer, you can watch on your TV with an Apple TV box or a Roku box. They're inexpensive and easy to use. And you can watch all of those movies and TV shows instantly. When you begin watching one movie on one device, you can finish it on a different one, which is great if you like to move around or if you're multitasking and just filling time. Netflix is very good at facilitating that. Whichever way you choose to access it, you can watch as many movies and TV shows as you want, anytime you want, and you can cancel anytime. So go try it today for free if you have not already, and tell friends, if they have not, that there's a great offer if you go to netflix.com/twit, because then you can get 30 days free of the wonderful Netflix service. Be sure and use that URL when you sign up for your free trial, netflix.com/twit. We are so grateful for Netflix's support of This Week in Law and the TWiT Network, and we hope you enjoy watching instantly with Netflix. All right, Larry, Netflix actually sort of kind of tangentially figures into our story about spectrum auctions and legislation, because it seems to me this is a tale of shifting means of consumption. And we have the incumbent cable and satellite carriers with a whole lot of spectrum that really other people might be better suited to use in today's day and age. Tell us what's going on.
Sure. You know, this is one of those stories that I pay attention to it so you don't have to. Spectrum is a remarkably complicated regulatory morass over at the FCC. But here's the big problem. We've run out of spectrum. Up until, you know, a few years ago, the government still had unattached, unlicensed spectrum. And as new devices or new uses for the radio waves came along, there was, you know, radio frequencies that could be assigned to those. That's no longer the case. We have no unassigned. And obviously the positive, the happy story of the last 10 years, certainly especially the last 5 years, has been the mobile revolution. All the devices, the smartphones and the iPads and the smart televisions. And increasingly I saw in Las Vegas a few weeks ago, the smart appliances, all of which are going to communicate more and more stuff. And they're going to use more and more data to do it. And obviously they want to do it wirelessly if possible. So the FCC, to its credit, has been leading the charge on this for the last 3 years. Chairman Julius Genachowski has been saying, we are facing a crisis. We have spectrum to offer, but the existing spectrum is being used to capacity, certainly in mobile services. And what he's been trying to do is to get Congress to give the agency authority to try and free up some of the spectrum that's not being put to, let's say, the best and highest use today. Two biggest potential sources of reallocating spectrum are government, which has a huge stockpile of spectrum. A lot of it isn't being used well or used at all. And then in the private sector, the best possible place to get spectrum would be from over-the-air television broadcasters. Obviously, over-the-air television broadcast is in steep, steep decline. They have lots of spectrum. Some of it's not being used. Some of it's not being used well. And what the FCC would like is the authority to have what's called voluntary incentive auctions, where broadcasters who want to give up some of their frequency that they're not using or they're not using can give it up. The FCC can sort of package that into useful blocks and then create some auctions. And, you know, obviously in an auction, whoever values the spectrum the most is going to take it, and presumably that's going to mean it goes to its best use. For a variety of reasons, has not given this authority to the FCC, and until they do, nothing can really happen. The problem now is it looked like they were getting pretty close at the end of last year. There's a Senate bill that very promising, and now there was a House bill that was introduced in November, I think, or October, that if passed would get the ball rolling here. The problem is sort of determining how much the FCC can shape the mobile market. The FCC has the ability, and they've used this power in previous auctions, particularly in 2008, to decide who can bid, who can't, conditions to attach to certain licenses, whether certain licenses have to go to very specialized uses like the interoperable public safety network. And the chairman made a speech at CES in Las Vegas where he said, you know, if you can't give us complete freedom to shape this market the way we want, then we don't want auction authority at all. And this created a real tempest in a teapot between Capitol Hill and the FCC now over, you know, who's really gets to decide what the FCC does and doesn't get to do, whether it's Congress or whether it's the FCC. But in the meantime, of course, you know, we're 3 years into a five-year plan, which required much, much more spectrum. And so far, almost nothing has been done. We're heading for a crisis. And unless we can break the gridlock in Washington, mobile users may really suffer.
So it seems like the chairman's complaints about the pending legislation have to do with overly tying the FCC's hands. with respect to the auctions they want to conduct. What's the motivation for wanting to tie the FCC's hands? We know, you know, who the driving forces behind SOPA and PIPA were. Who wants to lock up the way these auctions are held? And if it's the incumbents, why do they want that?
Well, so, you know, who it really depends on who you're asking here. I mean, the bottom mm-hmm. line is the main bone of contention is whether or not the FCC can disqualify bidders for certain blocks of this mythical spectrum that may or may not ever show up. Under the House bill, they cannot restrict who gets to bid in any of the auctions that come out of this voluntary system. What the FCC has done in the past and what they want to do with any new auctions is they want to be able to set aside certain blocks of spectrum and say, you can't bid for these blocks if you already have a certain spectrum. And so the FCC wants to be able to say to Verizon and AT&T and to a lesser extent to Sprint, these are auctions you can't participate in. Well, and this is what they did in 2008. The result was that billions of dollars in some of these blocks got left on the table that would have otherwise gone to the Treasury. And also means that, you know, in some sense, the FCC is picking winners and losers in terms of how it wants to see mobile competition exist. They want to see a certain number of competitors in certain markets, and they want to be in charge. And, of course, the House Republicans, their view is, no, the market should be in charge here in terms of defining how much competition there is, and we should be able to get as much money from these new auctions as we possibly can. So why would we give the authority to the FCC to disqualify otherwise qualified bidders who might be willing to pay billions for some of this?
Right. So what should we look for coming down the pike? Do you think that the chairman's complaints about this will have any impact?
Yes. I think we were very close to at the end of the year. The authority was included in a couple of different versions of the ongoing, you know, budget bills, and the continuing for budget would have kind of slid this authority in there. Given, I think, the speech he gave in Las Vegas, now we're back to a very different place. And I don't think that the House Republicans are in any mood to compromise with a federal agency that supposedly answers to them and not the other way around. So my fear is that, you know, if we don't see something break this logjam by March, that's probably about the end of the likelihood of Congress doing any substantive lawmaking before the election in October. You know, watch for this for the next couple of months. If they don't find a way to reach agreement and between the House and the Senate, between Congress and the FCC and the White House, it's very likely that we won't get any new spectrum legislation until after the election. That will depend very much on who wins and who loses.
Right. So say that happens. Say we don't, and we never get to these auctions that the FCC wants to hold. What then happens to all of the mobile devices we've seen proliferating?
Right. So, I mean, this is one of the questions I've been asking the chairman, which is, what's plan B? If we can't get auction authority, what else can we do in the meantime to make sure that the mobile revolution doesn't come to a crashing halt? And there, it turns out there's a lot of things that can be done. A lot of it is technological, ways of making more efficient use of existing spectrum. I mean, just moving people, for example, from, you know, there's still millions of people who have 2G devices, 2G phones. If we magically get them all to 4G, particularly to 4G LTE calls, it's a much more efficient use of the spectrum, and that would take off a lot of pressure right there. Better use of existing sites and antennas. This would require, for example, you know, easing local zoning restrictions and speeding up the process by which new antennas or new cell towers or pole attachments can be done. New technologies for kind of sharing spectrum. Better use of the unlicensed part of the spectrum. That's what Wi-Fi and other things use. These would really, I think, start to look like much more important things in the plan B if Congress goes away without granting new auction authority this year. I expect what will happen is we'll start hearing a lot more about the plan B if plan A doesn't make any progress.
IRC keeps chiming in that Julius Janikowski's on the phone and wants to put in his 2 cents here. let's see. Mary and Evan, I know I myself, you know, I'm just happy to hear Larry's take on all this and be brought up to speed. But if you guys have anything to add, I'd love to hear it. Mary? On the spectrum issues?
No, sorry. No, I don't really have anything to add.
Okay, Evan?
I had heard about the Plan B stuff, but, you know, nothing new.
Okay. Mr. Brown?
I guess what I would take out of all this is that, you know, I don't have much to substantively say on the spectrum issue itself, but what I would comment on more is the appropriate role of the FCC in all of this and how it is supposed to be the group of smart people, technologists, economists, and everybody advising Congress in all of this. So, isn't it intriguing to see how the FCC is continually being challenged on this issue of spectrum and, once again, network neutrality and all of these things, how the advance of progress technologically is just really challenging it and continually making it more difficult for it to do its job. And so this is kind of the latest incarnation of that. So that's my takeaway from it.
All right. Well, next I want to talk about the iBooks author flap. And all of this just reminds me that we have such great people on Twill all the time. Today is no exception. And we did recently on Twill 135 have Josh Fenton on. And he is someone who did an extensive paper on, what would happen if somebody were to insert into their EULA for some kind of content creation tool that they can exclusively control the distribution of that content. And he did that as kind of a thought piece. Apparently, Apple's lawyers either read or didn't read it. It would be interesting to know. Or just kind of didn't pay that issue much attention or didn't think it would get much public attention. But it sure has. Because while Apple has rolled out its new version of iBooks and the complimentary authoring tool, which is supposed to be wonderful, great, produces ebooks of a kind never yet before seen on the face of the earth. Apple has indeed done what Josh predicted someone would do, and that is try and tie up the distribution, basically by saying that if you create with that tool, you have to sell through the Apple iBooks store only. Evan, you contributed to a piece over at Ars Technica on this, along with Dan Brown, who Dan pointed out in that article that what this really means is not only do you have just one channel for distribution using this authoring tool, but also since Apple has complete control over what goes in the iBook store, you may have no channel of distribution. Now, of course, you have other tools you could use. Nobody's twisting your arm making you use iBooks Author. And yet still, it's an interesting tack for Apple to take. You want to give us your take on it, Evan?
It may come as no surprise to you that I think that this is a bunch of hand-wringing. And, you know, I'm wondering why it is that when things like this come up, you know, is our whole society just becoming a bunch of hand-wringers? And, I'm taking this little a quip from a piece that you know is kind of going on with like the Google changing its privacy policy, all that brouhaha going on. The question is just the commentators out there trying to out panic the others? I don't see what the big deal about this is. It's just a bunch of FUD, I think. Apple is giving away this software for free. It's not claiming a copyright interest in the works that are produced. Contrary to popular belief, it is not doing that. It's merely putting a condition on the use of the software that is tied to how the works are going to be subsequently used. The best analogy that I can think of for a comparison is, say, that I walk up to Barnes & Noble, and Barnes & Noble says, here is a printer, here is some ink. Why don't you go write your book, print it out, You know, put it on this paper and this, use this printer and this ink that we're giving to you for free. We're not charging you anything to use this stuff that we're giving you. If you write something good, we'll put it on the shelves in Barnes and Noble. If not, well, you know, you're free to do with it whatever you want. You know, you can give the copies away to your cousin, or, you know, put it, you know, on the corner and let people take copies of it or whatever. But, you know, we're Barnes and Noble. We have some quality control here. We're only going to let good works be published in our bookstores. Would anybody have an objection to that? They would think, no, this is great. You're giving me a free printer and ink, some paper, and there would be no controversy whatsoever. Barnes and Noble would be looked at as probably benevolent for having done that. So, you know, it, to me, it seems perfectly reasonable for Apple to be doing what it's doing here, giving away some, you know, extremely technologically advanced software that was developed at great cost, the ability to use it for free, claiming no ownership in the content itself. So if you want to create a work that, you know, there are ways of, it looks like there are ways of kind of manipulating the EPUB format so that it wouldn't be too difficult to you know, create it in some other platform and sell it on Amazon or sell it, you know, through some, any other of the you know, the gazillion ways of selling ebooks online. It seems to me a perfectly reasonable, perfectly fair thing for Apple to be doing to try to recoup some of its costs, just saying, hey, you know, would you please, you know, if you're going to sell this, make money off of this product that we have given to you to use for free, could you do us the courtesy of, you know, just making money through us so that we can take a little bit of cut, help recoup some of our costs? That doesn't seem, oh, and by the way, you know, we're trying to make that legally enforceable. You know, we're not just asking you, we're kind of telling you to do that. It seems reasonable to me. Now, that's all just kind of the business economics, setting aside like the legal issues, whether or not it's really enforceable for it to do that. But my my first off-the-cuff reaction is to think, you know, what's the big deal here? Why is it not reasonable for Apple to insist upon this if you're going to use the software that it's given to you for free?
Mary, do you have any thoughts on why it wouldn't be reasonable?
Well, I don't know. I think I disagree a little bit with him. I, you know, the idea that the output of the files is in a format that is proprietary and only iBooks can read it, and you know, it kind of feels to me like they're creating a business agreement and a technical regime that, you know, feels very forced. I don't think it's right. I don't like it. I wouldn't use it. But I suppose if everybody has adequate notice, you know, maybe it is reasonable for them to do this. I actually think it kind of smacks of some antitrust issue. I mean, the idea that, you know, if I create a Google Doc, do I have to publish it in, you know, Google, or somehow make money through Google? I mean, is that where we're heading, where every single piece of software and my use of it then means that I have to distribute through that company? And I mean, it seems to me that We are inching forward at a really rapid rate toward a world where it's just a gazillion big silos, and you got to pick your silo. So you pick your software, and you're locked into that whole silo over here, where it's the software and the distribution and the reader, and, oh, I like to read with this stuff, so now I've got to only read those kinds of books that were published there. So we, you know, I mean, maybe this is okay. Maybe this is like the studio system in the 50s in Hollywood, where actors got locked into studios, which were locked in with writers, which were locked in with directors, and locked in with movie theaters for distribution. You know, maybe it's the same thing. Maybe if you want to go and see John Wayne, you only can see John Wayne working with that writer and that director and in that kind of a story. And that's it. I don't know. It doesn't seem to me to be good for creativity. It doesn't, you know, copyright for me is supposed to be about, you know, encouraging creativity and supporting creators. And for me, digital copyright, which isn't something that we have codified, but I think of it as something that we do in practice, digital copyright for me online is about my right to distribute and copy, whether I'm the end user or the, you know, I have different rights in different circumstances, or I'm the creator and I'm distributing. And to me, the idea that companies insert themselves into all of this and lock things down is just wrong. It doesn't support creativity, in my view. It doesn't support distribution. I mean, if I were creating a book, I would want more people than just the folks that use the iBook system to, you know, to be able to enjoy my book. I mean,
right.
It's just, but then I think it's really weird.
The thing that comes to mind when you say that for me is all of the, you know, Apple only iPad apps that are books that are very rich. And, you know, I have a little kid. So, you know, for example, over Christmas, the book version of the Charlie Brown Christmas came out and, you know, was very popular, sold great in the iTunes store. I believe it is only available on the Apple platform, although if that's wrong, somebody correct me. And the notion that someone might be able to lock themselves in and be happy, I think is borne out by the fact that there are numerous examples of that in the Apple App Store. Now, do I think it's necessarily a good long-term business decision? Oh, they're telling me the Charlie Brown Christmas is available on Android, but there are others, I think, that are just in the Apple Store. Do I think it's a good long-term business decision? And do I agree with everything that Mary's saying about, you know, it's better for creativity to not have this kind of a regime in place? Absolutely, I agree with that. But looking at it from the legal standpoint, I think I agree with Evan that, you know, Apple's entitled to make these decisions unless there is an antitrust concern that pops in by creating an ecosystem that no one else has access to and that Apple controls, and then Apple gets market dominance. What do you think, Larry? Do you think that antitrust is a danger in this kind of decision for Apple?
No. The short answer is there's no antitrust issue here at all. Mm-hmm. As you say, Denise, this is a business decision. And by the way, it's the business strategy that Apple's pursued all along. And you can say it oftentimes, but their position has always been, you know, we want a premium product, and that means we have to have considerable control over what goes in and what goes on to our platforms, to our equipment, to our app stores, you know, to all of this stuff. And for Apple, that's the way they do business. And many people think that's a good way of doing business. It's not the only way. And of course, there are other alternatives. I think Evan's metaphor is a good one, but I think even better one would be to say, compare this user agreement to any publishing agreement. I've signed lots of publishing agreements with publishers, and the trade-off is I give them some, most, in some cases, all of my rights as the copyright holder to exclusive distribution of the work that I'm writing in exchange for the use of their platform, their publicity, their publishing, their access to the what used to be called bookstores. I don't know what they're called now. But publishing agreements are as old as history, and some people are doing is replicating the traditional publishing agreement for their digital platform. As I say, whether that's a good business decision or not, the answer really depends on what you think of Apple's business strategy overall. It certainly works. It's not the only way to do it. And obviously, we'll find out for this particular application if that works for them or not.
Yeah, Larry, I mean, you know, that is great that you bring it into, you know, extend the metaphor to consider the traditional publishing contract. And you know, in fact, as you're pointing out, the traditional publishing contract is even more onerous because it actually does implicate the copyright interest of the resulting work. I said this in my first comments on this, the Apple EULA does not do that. All it does is a restriction on the manner of distribution. Apple is not even pretending to claim any copyright rights in the work itself. itself. It's just making the use of your work, the manner of distribution, a condition on the use of the software. So, yeah, publishing contracts have been around for as long as publishing have, and they're even more restrictive, saying, you know, you can't even do anything with this work, author, with any other publisher for at least a certain period of time until we as the publishing house decide, you know, whether we're going to do something with it or not do something with it or what have you. You're much more cuffed, you know, in that sense, in the thing. So that's a very useful expansion of the metaphor.
Well, I don't know how I have Mary on the show and not talk again about Mega Upload and the arrests that were made and the hard crackdown that came sort of coincidentally in the wake of what happened last week with SOPA and PIPA getting withdrawn. Mary, do you think that other lockering services are in jeopardy because of what happened to Mega Upload? I mean, it's all sort of a shade of gray or variations. What am I looking for? Different places on the spectrum for how much infringement is going on any of these services.
Yeah, at the same time as the Mega Upload thing was happening, who was it? Pirate Bay was putting out a press release saying we're the new Hollywood. I think everybody's quote unquote in danger. I think that, you know, if Homeland Security can get their hands on your domain or, go after, you know, the folks who run a system that has some piracy flowing through it, even if there's other stuff happening, then they're going to try to do it. I mean, we saw that with several thousand domains that Homeland Security shut down a while ago. I mean, it's, you know, this is an ongoing thing. And, you know, the problem is that Hollywood has convinced the government that the only way to deal with all of these issues is to shut everything down. And, you know, I have to say, every time I hear one of these stories, which it feels like it's happening daily and we all read all the stuff, I have a couple of reactions. First of all, I think that that TechDirt had a fantastic article, which I posted onto Facebook yesterday or the day before, about how, you know, they were comparing Hollywood to that old joke about the guy who believes in God and, you know, the flood's coming and a truck comes to save him. And he says, no, I believe in God. God will save me. And he lets the truck go. And then he does it with a boat. And then he does it with a plane. And he drowns and he ends up in heaven. And God says, what do you want? I sent a truck, a boat, a plane. Like, I tried to save you. You know, and so the TechDirt point was, you know, Silicon Valley keeps inventing new stuff and Hollywood keeps turning its back on it and saying, oh no, you know, we're going to wait to get saved by the anti-piracy folks in the government. And that's it. And, you know, so my reaction to this, I used to sort of be very leery of the idea of compulsory licensing. I had a lot of issues with it because I was concerned about privacy and the tracking of all of our intellectual stuff. But of course, that has completely gone out the window, especially with Google this week. Google has just increased all of their tracking of us. And I think that there's actually ways to do a compulsory licensing model without tracking everybody. I think you could have ISPs keep data for 30 days or 60 days and then toss it out. I think you could reward, you know, creators in a much more direct way than we do right now. I think that you could let people who never use anything off the hook because you'd know that they using any media. And I think we could just stop all this stupidity. You know, who cares where you get your media? Money's being passed along. And I think we really, really need to reconsider. I think it was Terry Fisher at Harvard at the Berkman Center who kind of was out pitching this for a while. And he had a particular version of compulsory licensing, which had a lot of issues. But this would be maybe like 2004, 2005. I think we should look at it again. I think this is just absolutely stupid. What a waste of time. Get Hollywood to just, you know, get in the freaking lifeboat and move on. You know, it's dumb.
Yep, absolutely. Larry, any thoughts on this?
Well, you know, Mary's right. I don't think it's that easy, of course, to get embedded incumbent industries into the lifeboat. But eventually that's what happens. And I think what this story and, you know, in some ways SOPA as well kind of point to is we are in a amazingly deep transformation period where disruptive technology has undone the supply chain of all traditional media, started obviously with print, and now it's moved to, you know, to music and then now to movies as the bandwidth and the technology gets better for using digital channels. It's not surprising, it's disappointing, but it's not surprising that traditional industries resist that kind of life-changing event, and that they are slow to take advantage of the technologies that become available to them. This is historically what they've always done. Historically, they've always tried to use legal systems, either, you know, legislation or the courts, to slow those transformations as much as they can. But of course, ultimately, they realize in a certain amount of time, how much we don't know, but that those are technologies are, as Mary says, they're going to save them. So, you know, the VCR was going to end Hollywood as we know it. And of course, the VCR saved Hollywood. And I'm sure we'll be saying the same thing in the future about digital distribution in general. But in this interim period, it's entirely predictable that there will be this kind of resistance and that it will expend as much money as they've got in the vault to try and stop the progress of new channels and new technologies. And obviously, you know, there's counterweight on the other side to keep them from doing that. But in this interim period, you see a lot of weird behavior. You see a lot of skewed results. In the end, it all kind of washes out.
There's a funny GIF that Sean Bonner posted over on Google Plus. I don't know if Colin in the studio can pull it up for us or not, but in the event not, I'll just tell you it's a clip from Pirates of the Caribbean with Captain Jack cruising by the hanged bodies of pirates who've been captured. And on his forehead is pasted the word Tumblr, and on one of the dead ones is Mega Upload. So he's saluting them as he cruises on by.
And then Michael Bolton breaks in. Never mind.
Yes, there we go. There's, you know, Captain Jack.
What we have to be worried about here is, in addition to, as I say, this natural resistance, unfortunate but natural resistance, is obviously we also want to make sure that we maintain due process. And the government and the private parties are using the court system. I think they're stretching it just about as far as you can. And many people would say plausibly that they've stretched it beyond the limits of what the Constitution requires. There's been no trial about Mega Upload. Obviously, you know, you can get injunctions, you can stop things while the legal proceedings are going on. And then, of course, you can drag them out as long as possible to make sure that even if you turn out to lose, you win. Because the person that you enjoined is no longer able to defend themselves financially. They're no longer in business because, you know, their customers have all gone elsewhere. If it turns out that Mega Upload is a, you know, serious criminal enterprise, we're not going to feel sorry for them. But every time there's a mistake, and as Mary mentioned, there have been many mistakes in the sort of two-year campaign that the Department of Homeland Security has been using these laws for up till now. Every time there's a mistake, we should really ask, you know, there's no way to make those people whole when it turns out that we blocked them or we stopped them or we enjoined them and they were innocent. That's sort of an error cost that the legal system accepts. But the rest of us ought to be asking if that cost is too high.
Yep, totally agree. Well, the legal system has been grinding away this last week with a couple of important decisions on the privacy front. From the United States Supreme Court, we saw a decision in the U.S. v. Jones case, which we've been tracking here on the show. This is the one about the warrantless placement of a GPS tracker on a suspect, where there was some very interesting oral argument before the Supreme Court, and this the spectrum of the justices themselves having devices placed on their vehicles and being tracked around. This was a hypothetical they posed in the oral argument segment, and the answer to that question in oral argument was yes, you know, no one would be exempt, and who knows whether that swayed the court or not. But the court fairly unsurprisingly, given the hard questions they were asking counsel at oral argument, decided that, yes, indeed, if you're going to place a device like this on someone's car as part of an evidence gathering endeavor, that is indeed a search under the Fourth Amendment and requires a warrant. And there were some interesting discussions all around in the opinion. Evan, you want to tell us more about the outcome of this and any thoughts you have in its aftermath?
Yeah, Justice Scalia wrote the majority opinion. It was, you know, all nine Supreme Court justices decided. I think you may have said that. It was like a unanimous decision. There were like four concurring opinions, but everybody agreed that it was improper to track this guy Jones using the GPS device attached to his car without having a valid warrant to do that. So, you know, we up until the decision came down, you know, certainly the way that I was thinking about this, you know, I'm not a constitutional law scholar. I like the Constitution. I like the Fourth Amendment, like thinking about it, talking about it and all that stuff. I'm glad I enjoy the protections of the Fourth Amendment, but certainly am no scholar. And so my expertise pales into comparison to those people who talk about this stuff all the time. You know, I think everybody was thinking about this as a privacy case, and we still are kind of talking about it in the context of privacy. But if you read Justice Scalia's opinion, this was more of a property case, looking at the Fourth Amendment, which gives us the right to be free from unreasonable searches and seizures as they pertain to our persons, you know, ourselves, our property, or our effects. And so the Justice Scalia's opinion here looked at the physical intrusion that the cops did in placing this GPS device on the car and said, hey, you know, if pretty much, he said, the forefathers had this in mind way back in the 1700s, that we would be putting stuff to track people on their property. I mean, he didn't go that so far as to actually say that, of course. But, you know, it was, you know, kind of channeling the framers of the Constitution's sensibilities in saying, you know, that this physical intrusion onto the property, onto the car, which is an effect of the person, is, you know, it violates the protections that the Fourth Amendment was set to put in place. So what that does, what the court did in deciding it in this way was avoiding this question that seems like we spent almost an entire episode of this show talking about back when we had Professor Cerdan from University of Colorado on the show talking about this, you know, do we have an expectation of privacy in this aggregate information that is made that is collected about us, which is all actually public information. You know, tracking somebody on the public streets for a whole month, not any part of that is really private information, but is there an expectation of privacy that you have in that if it's collected using a GPS device? Well, the majority opinion of the court didn't even, you know, have to get there, because you only talk about reasonable expectations of privacy if that's the kind of analysis that you're doing under the Fourth Amendment, which is a relatively late invention, starting with the Katz case, K-A-T-Z. The more old school Fourth Amendment jurisprudence that Justice Scalia was channeling these 18th century sensibilities looked at it as a property interest. And so that was enough for him to say, hey, it was no good that the cops put this GPS device on this drug dealer's car without a warrant. You know, therefore, even though this guy should have been going to prison for the rest of his life for being a massive cocaine distributor, he can walk free because it was unreasonable to invade his physical property in that way. So that, with all of that said, there's still plenty of things for us to talk about in the privacy space with all of this. But technically, it was more of a property issue that drove the majority opinion's decision, you know, the majority of the court's decision in this case. So lots of interesting stuff to talk about.
Yeah, one of which is in Justice Sonia Sotomayor's concurrence, where she talks about possibly the need to rethink the third party doctrine, because so much of our data, as Mary was pointing out earlier, is now consigned to third parties who hold it, and we have an expectation perhaps that, you know, we have decided to trust them for whatever reason, and we're happy to have the data reside there. But what the third party doctrine says is that once you've shared it with a third party, it's no longer private. It loses its Fourth Amendment protections and the government can subpoena it. Mary, do you agree with Justice Sotomayor that we might have to rethink that?
I do think that we have to rethink it. I mean, one thing I would say is that the research shows that users don't actually know that their data is going to third parties. They believe that, like, in a high percentage, like 80 to 90% of the cases, and these are recent usability research things that have been done in the last year or two, and they've conducted a lot around the Do Not Track stuff that the FTC was doing, and they were presented last April at Princeton at the W3C FTC event. Basically, users don't understand when they access a website and they share some data that the data is really going to not just one third party, but like a whole bunch, right? And website owners are under tremendous pressure to share data about what the users do to allow beacons to be put on the website. The users don't understand that beacons are there and that they're tracking them not just on one website, but they're actually tracking the user from multiple sites. And, you know, in the What They Know series that the, you know, Wall Street Journal did two summers ago and then followed up with some additional articles last year, showed was that, you know, the beacons, the fingerprinting of machines that can be done very easily. You can get 97% of the people can be fingerprinted in a unique way because of the configuration of their machines and their IP addresses and whatnot. That you can actually pretty well track people all around the web. And the trackers are not coming directly from a specific website, unless it's Google or Yahoo or one of the really big properties, Facebook. In most cases, when a user goes to, for example, let's say they go to the Huffington Post, that's a pretty big site, and the user sees a Facebook like button, they don't realize that Facebook is actually tracking them there, watching what they watch, and tracking them as they go from page to page to page, and looking at what ads they click on and what they're doing. So it's, I mean, part of what you just stated about Sotomayor's assessment of, you know, we should rethink the third-party doctrine, is that the users don't get that they're sharing this information. So how can a user have a reasonable expectation around, oh, I shared my data with a third party? They don't even know who the third parties are, and they don't understand that it's happening. It's not like, oh, I went to Amazon and I authorized UPS to have my address. There I understand there's a third party getting my information. Well, I'm actually dealing directly with UPS too, so UPS kind of slides into the second party state with me if I'm the first party. It's what all the folks that I don't have relationships with. It's all the businesses that are collecting data and selling. It's Intellius and Rapleaf and Axiom who are, and many other companies like them, who are tracking us and selling that information, and they really don't want us to know that they're doing it. And those are the third parties. We have no relationship with them. They have a ton of information about us, and actually, they're completely primed to be personal data stores, except they forgot to tell us. So if we had some sort of legislation where there was rights and responsibilities about being able to see what data was collected about me, then they could come to me and say, hey, I've already got the whole architecture for a PDS or a personal data store. Do you want me to be your personal data store? And then I would have the choice of saying yes or no, and I'd have some notice. But right now we have none of that. So the whole third party idea where I would know that I was suddenly losing my Fourth Amendment rights because I shared my data with a third party is ridiculous. Nobody knows where all that data is going. They don't understand it at all. It's, you know, the system is way ahead of even the thinking that we should rethink the third party doctrine. You know, the technology, like, it's an arms race. As soon as users could delete cookies 3-4 years ago, what happened? We beaconed out, we fingerprinted, we did all these things so that users, you know, we made flash cookies that users can't even delete. And now the users are really pissed. And Do Not Track isn't going to work. And my view of Do Not Track is, at the point where we say, oh, yeah, this is the answer, then the users say, great, I'm not going to be tracked anymore. I just shut everything off. except all the tracking will continue. And in about 3 years, not only will the users be pissed at the services that are tracking them, they'll be pissed at the FTC, they'll be pissed at all the advocacy orgs that supported Do Not Track, and we'll all be standing around twiddling our thumbs and saying, wow, we let another 3 years go by and we didn't really fix this. And I think the answer is rights and responsibilities, where the user's in charge of their own data, and any service that wants my data needs to come talk to me at my PDS or my personal data store. I think that's the answer. And all that's being built, and we're trying for it. But, you know, we're just a long way away from getting that system in place.
Well, keep on going on it, Mary. I think there's a big need. Yeah. Interestingly, in Colorado, even without incorporating any third parties, there was a case that came down recently. We covered it before on Twill. I'm not going to try and pronounce Fricasso, perhaps, was the defendant's name. And the district court there, the issue there was this woman was suspected of mortgage fraud. And there was information on her personal laptop that was encrypted that the government wanted access to. She argued, and the EFF filed an amicus brief, that she had a Fifth Amendment privilege against self-incrimination for the data on her laptop that she had not consigned over to any third parties. And the district court just recently, this last week, decided the Fifth Amendment was no barrier here to ordering the woman to decrypt and turn over what the prosecutors wanted in the case. Evan, any quick thoughts on this?
When the first week of my first year of law school, there was a professor, it was like for some kind of general law class that kind of just teaches you about being a lawyer. It wasn't like torts or contracts or something like that. It was Professor Reese at the University of Denver College of Law. He said, you know, guess what? Judges, you know, sometimes appellate court judges especially, will get a case, take it back into chambers, and go back and discuss among themselves. Start off the discussion with something like, how on earth are we going to keep this factory in business and not leave our community? So what they're doing here is deciding how it has to come out, how what the conclusion has to be, what the decision has to be, and then go back, post hoc and figure out the rationale of getting there. I have a suspicion that that's kind of what was going on here. The judges, it was at the district court level, federal district judge in Colorado said, look, I've got a defendant here. There's a mountain of evidence against her that she was engaged in this activity with her ex-husband to steal people's homes, to commit mortgage fraud. She's a really bad person. There's all kinds of evidence that suggests that. How am I going to get around this argument that she is entitled to not have us see what's on this computer that we have in our custody that she's talked about on the phone with her husband? We have recordings with her talking about, you know, the thing that is on the computer. And yeah, it's password protected. And it's like, yeah, I kind of want them to find out, but then I don't want them to find out. You know, she's being a real smart aleck about, you know, what's actually on it. The judge is put in a position, how on earth, can I avoid actually finding in favor of this defendant where the evidence that seems to be here really shows her guilt already. So what we have here is a decision. Looks like a pretty bad defendant, evidence that she's doing bad things. And again, she's innocent until proven guilty and all that stuff. But there's a bunch of other evidence that shows she's doing bad stuff. And so what we have here is a situation where the court had to make sure that it got to the decision that it got to. And that's why we have kind of a strained analysis that is pretty easily attacked. How is it that being forced to turn over the contents of a hard drive is, and you having essentially knowing that you have to enter the password to do that, how is that not a testimonial act that should be covered under the Fifth Amendment? That's what I think that went on here, and I think it's it puts us in a pretty strange situation when it comes to the protectability of encrypted hard drives.
All right. Well, there's lots more that went on this week, but we need to bring this show in for a landing. Hopefully, we'll get to some of these other hot stories in the next episode of This Week in Law. But we don't want to leave you without our tip and resource of the week. We talk a lot about folks posting things online and not knowing the ramifications of what they're doing, getting themselves in legal or employment trouble. or just, you know, in the bad graces of their friends. There's a good piece in Real Simple that's our resource of the week. It's called Social Disgraces. And it talks about, you know, this, basically some hints from Heloise, how to approach, some things to think about when you're using social media. It also has some great sidebars like what's the most annoying kind of Facebook update? What's the most irritating status update you've seen in the past 24 hours? So check that out over at Social Disgraces, and it will help you consider how you lead your online life. And then our tip of the week is actually 6 tips about the new proposed EU privacy framework. This is over at Données Personnelles, and it's by Thibault de Vergran. And he has basically 6 things you need to know about what the EU wants to pass. A 27-countrywide regulation that will codify the right to forget and will have various other huge ramifications, including large, large fines for anyone who does business in the EU and runs afoul of these proposed new regulations. So I encourage you to go check that out. I also encourage you to go and listen to This Week in Google This Week, where Jeff Jarvis has a good rant about this proposed privacy framework. Hopefully we can get Jeff on the show soon to talk about it further. And with that, I want to thank our wonderful panel for a great episode of This Week in Law. Larry, it's been such a pleasure having you. You always leave us far more enlightened than we were when we began the show, so we greatly appreciate that.
I'll come back anytime, Denise. Thanks.
Wonderful. And in the meantime, you can find Larry. He's at LarryDowns.com and at Larry Downs on Twitter. And we appreciate all the great writing and work that you do. And of course, love having you on the show.
Thanks.
Mary, it's been wonderful having you on the show too. 10 years plus that I've known you, and it's still just a pleasure to sit down and get the chance to chat.
Thank you very much. It was great.
And folks, you can go find Mary at Napsterization. She's at Mary Hodder on Twitter. She's over on Google Plus and always has great observations about the topics we've been, of the kind we've been discussing today. And of course, Evan Brown, thanks so much for joining us again.
Well, thanks for having me, Denise. It's always such a privilege to be able to have conversations with the brilliant folks that that you bring on the show. So I really, really have enjoyed it. Great conversation.
Me too. And folks, don't forget to head over to Evan's blog, internetcases.com, and at internetcases on Twitter to find out everything that's current in the world of technology and internet law. And between the shows, please do email me. I get tons of good information from our listeners between the shows at denise@twit.tv, or you can drop a comment at our Facebook page. It's facebook.com/thisweekinlaw, or we're Twill on Google Plus. Love to hear from you in any or all of those venues, and we'll see you next week on the next episode of This Week in Law.